All right, I want to talk about what I call biblical compatibilism. This is probably a term that you may not be familiar with. If you've read the book, Defeating Evil, you've run across this term. And it's particularly explained in greater detail in my book, What About Free Will? It's a newer term, but the concept is been around for a long time, and it's basically enshrined in many of the great Protestant confessions of faith and a lot of the great theologians. Martin Luther would probably embrace this term today, most certainly Jonathan Edwards, John Owen, other great theologians in the Protestant tradition, particularly the Reformed tradition, that is connected with Calvinism. And basically the idea behind compatibilism is that there is a dual explanation for every choice that human beings make. There is a kind of double agency, we might say, for every human choice. On the one hand, as we've already seen, God, in his meticulous sovereignty, has decreed everything that takes place, including our choices. So one of the questions that is raised is, well, then how can we be morally responsible for our choices if God is ultimately in control of those things? But that is only one side of the equation. So even though God meticulously ensures every one of our choices, we also ensure our own choices by our own choosing, so that both things are true. God has decreed and providentially ensures what we will choose, but we also willingly choose in and of ourselves all that we do. Both things are true. My pastor at Kerrville Bible Church, Chris McKnight, our lead pastor, likes to call this the Twin Towers, a divine sovereignty and human responsibility. Both are true, and you cannot have one without the other. So, for example, just a few passages in Proverbs that embrace this dual notion, this dual agency, that are worth your consideration. For example, Proverbs 16:9 says, "The mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps." Man, you've got the Lord. Man, we plan our ways. We deliberate in our minds what we're going to do. But ultimately, it is the Lord that has directed our steps. Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast into the lap. You know, the dice is thrown on the floor. But it's every decision is from the Lord, right? We throw it out there, we put it out there, but ultimately it's the Lord that determines the outcome. Proverbs 19:21. Many plans are in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord will stand. Okay, so again, we deliberate, we decide, we finally make a decision, and whatever decision, whatever choices we make, they fit completely in line with the counsel of the Lord. Proverbs 21:1 says, "The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes." So again, the king has a heart, he deliberates, he makes decisions, he carries out those decisions And yet ultimately, it is the Lord who directs those decisions. So we could kind of characterize this dual agency this way. We can say that God is the remote cause of all of our decisions. In other words, he is not the direct or immediate cause of the choices we make. Rather, we are. Your own will is the direct or immediate cause of your choices, right? That makes your choices meaningful, right? Don't get the idea that, well, you know, God's going to do what he's going to do and it doesn't matter what I do. That is false, right? That actually is what we would characterize as something called fatalism. In the philosophical and theological literature, they call it hard determinism, right? So we believe that God determines all things, but it is not what we would call a hard determinism that is really hard to distinguish between what even many of the ancient Greek philosophers just essentially called fatalism. In other words, fatalism is the idea that what will be, and it doesn't matter what you do, it's going to happen regardless of what choices you make. Now, there's a sense in which that is true, but there's a very important sense in which that is not true, because God always operates via human agency in much of what he does in the world, such that there are means. God does not bypass our own will, right? Rather, God uses our will as the instrument by which he accomplishes his purposes. And our will is not, you know, we're not these sort of marionettes hanging on, you know, the puppeteer's strings, as some Arminians like to accuse Calvinists of holding to. No, our decisions are real. They come from us. They are made from our own heart. They are done voluntarily, willingly. And at the same time, they correspond to what God has also determined. Both realities are true. So God is the remote cause of our actions and also the primary cause, right? His sovereignty is the overall plan for what will happen. And our choices in that regard are secondary, even though they are the immediate cause. So God is the remote yet primary cause of our actions, and we are the immediate but secondary cause of our actions. Both things are true simultaneously. So, number of examples of that in scripture that I want to point you to. Number one, when you read, for example, Exodus chapters, early chapters of Exodus, where God brings the plagues against Egypt, and we read, if I recall correctly, I think we read 11 times that God hardens Pharaoh's heart. And yet, 10 times interspersed within those 11 occurrences of statements that indicate that God is hardening or has hardened the heart of Pharaoh, it says Pharaoh hardened his own heart. So yes, the question, well, which was it? Was it God or was it Pharaoh? Did God harden Pharaoh's heart at one point? And Pharaoh's heart, he didn't harden his own heart in those moments. So did he like somehow sense, well, I've got this sense of foreign hardening of my heart and I'm not in control of my own actions, Right? Did he have that sense? And then at other moments where he's like, oh, I'm in total control of my actions now, and I'm hardening my heart, and God has nothing to do with it. No, that's ridiculous. Both things are true at the same time. God has hardened Pharaoh's heart, but that has not somehow mitigated the fact that he himself is also hardening his own heart. Let's look at a couple of passages in that regard. Go to Exodus chapter 7. Moses had one of these encounters with Pharaoh and Aaron and the staffs and the magicians of Egypt, and he throws his staff down. They turn into snakes. His staff is thrown down and swallows up all their staffs and all that. Verse 13 then says, yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened. This is a passive indicating that God is probably the actor here. He did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. So on the one hand, his heart was hardened. It could be that Pharaoh is the object of the hardening of his own heart there in verse 13, though I think it is the Lord. But in verse 14, it's very clear that Pharaoh's heart is stubborn, meaning that's the condition of his heart, and he willingly refuses to let the people go. Look at chapter 9. When Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail, verse 34, 9:34, but when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned again and hardened his heart. The reason why I'm pointing out this verse is to show that his own intentions, his own stubborn heart, which represents the motives of his heart that are sinful, he is culpable for those intentions. And therefore, that's why it says he sinned again and hardened his heart. Now turn to chapter 10. This is perhaps the most interesting of all these verses, and we're not looking at all of them. But in verse 27, 10:27 says, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. And then this phrase is added, and he was unwilling to let them go. Well, which was it? Was it God's will that he not let the people go, or was it his own will? It's both. God hardened his heart, and yet at the same time, he was unwilling. He hardened his own heart in terms of letting the people go. Both things are true. Now, how did God harden Pharaoh's heart? Again, I don't know. I don't know the exact mechanics. I don't think, as I said before, that God implanted these evil thoughts in Pharaoh's heart. I think that would then make God culpable for the evil, if that were true, because then they wouldn't be Pharaoh's thoughts. So somehow in the mystery of God's providence, he ensures that Pharaoh's heart is hardened, but in no way does that mitigate the fact that Pharaoh himself does not want the people to go. And therefore, he has sinned and is morally culpable because of the intentions of his heart. God does not bypass the intentions of the heart. One of the most fascinating examples of this, go to 2 Kings. It's an obscure passage, but it's really fascinating. Turn to 2 Kings chapter 13. 2 Kings chapter 13. I'll just start back in verse 1. In the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, the king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, became king over Israel at Samaria, and he reigned 17 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he had made Israel sin. He did not turn from them. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Listen to this carefully. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, so he gave them, right, his providence. He gave them continually into the hand of Hazael, the king of Aram, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael. Okay, so here is the divine perspective of what is going on in this incident. God is bringing judgment to Israel and to Jehoahaz for his evil. And so he gives them into the hand of Hazael, the king of Aram, and Ben-Hadad, his son. Now, look at verse 4. Then Jehoahaz entreated the favor of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him, for he saw the oppression of Israel, how the king of Aram had oppressed them. Now think about this for a minute. This verse is written from totally the human perspective. And notice the way that it reads. It's like, he entreats the favor of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him like, wow, gosh, I didn't know this. You know, if you had not told me about this situation, I wouldn't have known. I'm glad you told me. Right? And then it says, for he saw the oppression of Israel. He's like, well, you know, you're telling me this. Let me look into this. And he looks and he sees, Well, there you have it. Aram, the king of Aram, has been oppressing my people Israel. How can that be? Well, it's because you decreed it. You see the tension there? But what I want you to see is the fact that God's response of then relieving the oppression of Israel came as a result of Jehoahaz humbling himself and coming before the Lord and praying. And God heard his prayer and answered and relieved the oppression of his people, the very oppression that he himself decreed. So what is important to see there is a divine perspective and there's a human perspective. And from the human perspective, this is like God is just kind of like a friend. Like, hey, can you come check this out? You know, look at this out. Oh, yeah, I see this. Let me help you out here. Like, he's just another human participant in the story. But in fact, he's the sovereign God of the universe. And yet, at the same time, Jehoahaz is praying, and that becomes the human means by which God responds from a human perspective and relieves the oppression of his people, so that Jehoahaz's prayer was effective and necessary, we would say, because God designed it that way. He always uses human means to accomplish most of his sovereign purposes. Turn to Genesis chapter 45. One of the most familiar stories in this regard. Genesis 45. We know the story. It's Joseph and his brothers. We know that Joseph grew up as a favored son of his father. And my guess is that Joseph took advantage of that. He was a brat. And his brothers knew it, and he didn't like it. And, you know, he tried to exploit his favored position. And they decided one day that they're going to get rid of their brother, and they sold him into Egyptian slavery and lied to their father and said that he was killed by a wild animal, took his famous multicolored coat and dipped it in blood, took to the father and said, wild animals killed your son. And Jacob mourned for his son, completely unaware that he'd been sold into Egyptian slavery. Fast forward, Joseph goes through all kinds of crazy things, accusations of rape and so forth. He ends up in prison. Then finally he tells the dreams of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh brings him onto his staff and puts him as second in command when a famine breaks out, which is related to the dreams that he interpreted for Pharaoh. And now Joseph is in this position of great power. And the famine happens, and Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to get some grain, and they had to face their brother, who they didn't know was in that position. And they have this initial meeting with him, and Joseph reveals himself, knowing who they are, and he says, I'm your brother. They're like, what? Yeah, the one you sold into slavery. In verse 5, he says, you know, they came closer, and he can tell that they're shaking in their boots now because this guy has power. And he says to them, now don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Stop. Notice that Joseph acknowledges that they have been feeling a sense of shame because of their guilt and culpability, moral culpability of doing this evil of selling him into slavery. He does not deny their moral culpability for their actions. Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Wait a minute, what? God sent me to Egypt. Well, how did he do that? Through the selling of Joseph by his brothers into slavery. That's the means by which he did that. Verse 6, for the famine has been in these land for 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. Verse 7, God sent me before you to preserve a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. And just in case they're not getting clear the message that Joseph is telling them, verse 8 says, now therefore it was not you who sent me here. What? Verse 5, he says, you sold me here. Now he's saying you didn't send me here. Well, what is true? They're both true. Ultimately, they did not send him there. God did. It was not you who sent me here, but it was God. In other words, God was the ultimate determiner of the actions of Joseph's brothers. He was the remote but primary cause of their actions. They were the immediate but secondary cause of their own actions. And in none of those realities is it true that somehow they are relieved of culpability for their actions. Turn to chapter 50. We see the next encounter. They come back with his little brother, Benjamin. And they're still scared shaking in their sandals. I don't think they had boots in those days. Verse 15 says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph bears a grudge against us and he pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him? This is a very real reality. Maybe Joseph was being merciful to them because his father was still alive and he didn't want to shame his father. Now his father's dead. Now he can really get them. Why do they feel this way? Because they are bearing the burden of the guilt for having done this evil deed many, many years ago of selling him into slavery. So they sent a message, verse 16, to Joseph saying, your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. There is nothing in that statement that is untrue. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. He understands the gravity of the situation that they find themselves in. And he's extending mercy to them. Verse 18, then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. I think this is an expression of their own repentance over what they had done. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? He's recognizing God's sovereignty over the entire affair. And then verse 50 is one of those key verses in the Bible that I think we should not miss, because it goes right to the heart of this whole question of moral culpability. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. Do you see what Joseph is affirming here? He is affirming a dual explanation for their evil actions. But he's doing more than that. He is affirming, on the one hand, that the intent of their hearts were evil for the evil deed that they did. And yet, at the same time, God, who superintended their actions, had a good intention for the evil that they did. Because it could be no other way. God must, of necessity, always have a good intention for any evil that occurs. And if he couldn't have a good intention for some evil that would occur, then he would not decree it to take place. Turn to Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2. It says, the day of Pentecost, the birth of the church, Peter is preaching. He's got a massive crowd of Jews, including the leaders. Of the people. He addresses them in verse 22. He says, men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. Do you see the compatibilism here? From the divine perspective, God predetermined that Jesus Christ, his son, would be crucified. In fact, it is very safe to say that this incident is the greatest evil that has ever happened. Why do I say that? Because it is the only time in history that a truly righteous man, a truly innocent man, a truly sinless, blameless man was wrongfully murdered. Nowhere else in history do you see such an egregious injustice, and it is magnified by the fact that this man was attested by God as the Messiah, a man who demonstrated his divine messianic status by miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. You know who this man was. You know that he claimed to be the divine Son of God, the messianic heir to the throne of Israel, and you crucified him nonetheless. You nailed him to a cross by the hands of godless men. This was evil in all of its fullness. And yet it was predetermined by God. Turn to Acts chapter 4. Later on, the church is gathered together. The upper room. They're praying. Together they pray this prayer in verse 27. To the Father, saying, truly in this city, Jerusalem, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. Now they're naming names. All right, this is not just a nebulous, oh, you crucified Jesus. No, he's not. They're now naming names. Herod and Pontius Pilate were implicated in the crucifixion of God's holy servant Jesus, whom he anointed, verse 28, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. Compatibilism. Herod and Pontius Pilate, out of the evil intentions of their own hearts, had Jesus crucified along with the Gentiles and the Jewish leaders. They're all crying for his crucifixion. They're all implicated in this sin as well. They're accessories to murder. And as Isaiah 53:10 tells us, it pleased God to crush his son. God used the greatest evil ever perpetrated against a human being in the history of the world, as I will show later, to achieve the greatest good that the world has ever seen. That is the beauty of God's sovereign plan. But at this moment, I just simply want you to recognize and understand that there is always a dual explanation for our choices. And we have our intentions, whether good or evil. And God has his intentions, which are always good, no matter what our intentions are. Because everything is being worked out according to his plan. Everything is coming to pass according to that plan. And his plan is supremely good and supremely wise. And would never include any instance of evil that did not contribute to that all good and all wise plan. And that leads me to really the beginning of session four. And we can move a little more quickly through this because I've set everything up for this moment. This is where we get to the heart of the matter. And what I call the greater glory theodicy. We'll get to that in a moment. But the Bible doesn't have any specific verse that you can turn to that says, and the Lord God ordained evil such that he might, you know, XXX. We don't have that kind of a verse. Right, there's no verse that tells us exactly this is why God ordained evil to take place in the world. But what we have is a lot of the theological foundations for making sense of the problem. But primarily what we have is we have the whole storyline of the Bible. And I believe that the theodicy, right, the explanation for God's purposes for evil is the whole Bible. It's the whole storyline of the Bible, which is a kind of microcosm of the whole story of history from beginning to end. And in order to set us up to see this, I want to begin by just talking about the importance of stories. I talk a lot about this in both of my books. And stories are so important to human existence. We've known this forever. Stories help us make sense of the world. You know, when you are meeting someone and they say, well, tell me about yourself, you meet with, I don't know how your membership process works here, but in our church, we have an interview with the members, you know, potential members of our church, and we want to hear their story. We want to hear their testimony for sure, you know, how they came to faith in Christ. But we want to hear it in the context of their story. Tell us about yourself. Where were you born? Where'd you go to school? Who are your children? We want to hear their story because stories are important to place our lives in context. And usually when you tell your story, you leave out all the trivial stuff and you focus on the things, the key things, right? The important events of your life. And you craft this story, you narrate a story for yourself, and this is who you are, and you convey it by talking about your story. And we love stories, right? And we love fiction. We love movies, and we love novels, and we even love history, and history, good history, is told like a good story. You read the Bible, which is history, It's always told in the context of the way a good story is told. And good stories always have a particular pattern. It's what we might call a conflict resolution kind of pattern. Every good story has this conflict resolution pattern. There's always a kind of poignant conflict that the story deals with, and then there's a compelling resolution to that story, if it's truly a good story. And there are certain assumptions about how stories should be told, so it should be told. Number one, there's an assumption about how things ought to be, right? Utopia, you might say, although the origins of utopia are not so good. The real utopia, but you understand what I mean. Paradise, unfallen Eden. It's the way things are supposed to be. But somehow things have gone wrong. And so the story focuses on how things have gone wrong. And then thirdly, how to make them right again. And so really every good story is kind of a U-shaped. If you think of the letter U, you think of the way how things ought to be, the ideal sort of conditions of the way life should be. And then the conflict is the bottom part of the U, you know, that bring the crisis or the conflict in the story is how things should not be. And then in the resolution of the story, the idea is to somehow bring us back to the way things are supposed to be, right? So in a good story, you know, a lot of times you'll have a hero and you'll have a villain. The villain is connected to the crisis of the story, and the hero is introduced at some point to bring resolution to the crisis. All right, let me give you a simple example. I actually talk about this in my first big book. It's a story of the three little pigs, right? Didn't we all grow up listening to Three Little Pigs? All right, you got these three little pigs, and the first two are pretty stupid. You know, they each go out on their own. You know, they're in the big wide world now, and they're going to build their homes and build their futures. And so the first little pig builds a house, and he builds it with straw. And then suddenly the villain of the story is introduced, the big bad wolf. Right? And he comes because the pig, you know, built his house with straw. The big bad wolf puffs and he blows his house down. A little piggy has to run and goes to the next piggy's house. He builds his a little bit stronger. He builds with sticks, you know, not with straw. But that's nothing for this villain, right? Big bad wolf comes. You know, so the crisis is building. The conflict is building. How are these people going to survive? You know, they started out in this ideal world. They're going to build their homes. Everything's going to be an incredible life, right? But now they've got this crisis, and they've got this villain. You know, so now what are they going to do? Well, the whole conflict is building, right? And then so their two houses are destroyed, and they run to the next piggy's house. And now this guy, he's smart, right? He builds his house with bricks, right? And he's the hero of the story, right? And now the villain comes and the crisis is mounting because, what's going to happen here? Is he going to blow this house down too? Well, he huffs and he puffs and he can't blow the house down. So now you're thinking, well, good. So much for that. Well, no, it gets even more intense. He crawls up to the top of the house and starts to work his way down the chimney. But the hero of the story is really smart, right? So he gets a pot, he puts it under there, and he puts the boiling water and the wolf comes down and he boils in the water. And the tame versions of the story, the modern versions of the story, because this story is old, right? The big bad wolf gets hot and he jumps out of the pot and he runs. And the three little pigs all live together happily ever after. Conflict resolved, right? The original story, they actually boil the wolf and they eat it. But, you know, we don't want to tell that story to our little kids today. We're too soft. But you see this U-shape kind of pattern in all stories. Aristotle wrote about this, and he talked about stories that are good stories and bad stories, really comedies and tragedies. If you're familiar with Shakespeare, you know that Shakespeare always wrote either a comedy or a tragedy. Now, what does that mean? A comedy is not a funny story. A comedy is a story that ends well, where the hero wins, the conflict is overcome, and everyone lives happily forever after. A tragedy is when the hero fails. It becomes a tragic hero. And even though we're rooting for him to win, somehow he has some sort of fatal flaw that causes him to not overcome the crisis, and somehow he fails. And we don't like those kind of stories very well, and for good reason, because we want good stories. We want comedies. We want the story to end well. But the reason why tragedies are important is because it highlights that oftentimes life is not like that. And it drives us to long for the stories that end well. You know, great tragic figures in the Bible were, certainly Judas. You know, wouldn't we have wished that when Judas returned the money to the temple, that when he felt the weight of his sin, wouldn't we have wished that he would have ran to Jesus and fell on his knees and repented of his sins, and Jesus would have restored him? Instead, he hangs himself and commits suicide. Tragic figure. We see a lot of those in the Bible, and we see them in real life. But the good stories always have this U-shape, and I believe that God has kind of written in our DNA this longing. Even as unbelievers, we know the world is not the way it's supposed to be. There's evil. And we long for a world to be without evil. And so we craft these stories to assure ourselves that surely there's a good ending somehow. And I believe it reflects the storyline of the Bible, which I think is a U-shaped creation, fall, redemption. And the crisis of the story is immediately introduced in the early chapters of creation. We have the first two chapters where everything is great. Everything is the way it's supposed to be. The Garden of Eden, and suddenly the villain is introduced in the serpent, Satan, who enters into the garden and tempts the woman. And she succumbs to temptation, and now the crisis has fallen upon the entire world in just three short chapters of the Bible. And then the rest of the Bible is the resolution. Right, and we see hints of that resolution in Genesis 3:15, right? The seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent, right? Even as the serpent crushes the heel of the seed. This is a cryptic reference, of course, to the Messiah and his death, which is temporary, and the crushing of Satan that is permanent. And we already have a kind of forecasting of the end of the story just in that verse. And then the rest of the Bible is really, in a sense, an explication of Genesis 3:15. in the outworking of this promise to bring resolution to the crisis of the story. Back in the late 1800s, there was a French literary critic named Gustav Freytag, who came up with what's called Freytag's Pyramid. And this is used even today by novelists and Hollywood movie scriptwriters and storytellers. And it fits this sort of pattern. There's five sort of components to this pattern of how stories are told. The first is called the exposition. That's the back story, you know, that leads to the conflict. You know, you got to set the stage, so to speak, that leads to the conflict. Then the conflict is introduced, and that begins what's called the rising action, where the conflict begins to build and the plot thickens, you know, just like in the little Three Little Pigs story, right? And then you come to the climax of the story where there's a turning point and a resolution. And usually this is where the hero of the story, you know, finally figures out how to defeat the problem, whether it be the villain or whatever the problem is. And then, you know, once that turning point takes place, then you have the falling action where all of that then is worked out till you come to the final action, which is called the denouement, the final unraveling, or the beginning of the happy ever after, right? In scene credits, the hero's walking, you know, off into the sunset and everybody's cheering, yay! Right? Think of all your favorite stories, your favorite movies, even television shows. They all follow the same pattern, this whole conflict resolution pattern. And I have found it useful to take this pattern and show how the Bible fits it. Not that the Bible was anticipating Freytag's pyramid, but I think it's just a useful tool to see how the Bible itself works the same way, because I think the story of the Bible is their paradigmatic story of redemption. You have the exposition, which is the creation and the fall. The world is created the way it was supposed to be, and then suddenly the fall comes. Adam and Eve succumb to the temptation. The conflict is expressed. And then you have the rising action, which is this movement toward redemption. And there's two sort of trajectories to this. You have the human trajectory that could be expressed primarily through the giving of the law of Moses and Israel's failure to obey the law, that shows that they can't really resolve the crisis. There's got to be another way to resolve the crisis. And that points to the divine trajectory of the story, which is the promised seed of the woman that builds and builds and builds until we get to the climax of the story, which is the incarnation of the Son of God that leads to his death, the true climax of the story, and then the resurrection where everything now turns. And the rest of history pivots around those seminal events of the death and resurrection of Christ, in which the hero of the story defeats evil. Death and evil and everything that goes with it. And the falling action is how then, from the death and resurrection of Christ, and of course Christ's ascension, and how all of this now is getting worked out throughout the rest of history until its final consummation, when the king, the hero, returns and finally puts an end to all evil, establishes his kingdom, right, in stages, right? We have the millennial kingdom, Because then Satan is put in the abyss for 1,000 years. He's finally released one last time, and then he's crushed finally forever at the end of the millennium. Then you have the great white throne judgment, where the rest of unbelieving humanity is judged and God is glorified in their judgment. And then the Son delivers the kingdom to the Father, and it transitions into the eternal kingdom, in which the present heavens and earth are destroyed, undergo its own death, and then it's kind of resurrected, as it were, into the new heavens and the new earth, so that the creation itself experiences its own redemption, so that there is a place for the redeemed to live, a fit redeemed creation for the redeemed creatures of God to live forever with the King. Is there a better story than that? Paradise is restored. This leads to what I call the greater glory theodicy. The greater glory theodicy is actually an ancient theodicy, though it's never been really fully developed. It comes from an ancient hymn, probably written by Ambrose in the 4th century, in which he mentions what is called the Felix Culpa, or the fortunate fall that occasioned a great redeemer. And he calls the fall a fortunate fall. That's odd, because when you think of the fall of humanity, you're not thinking, well, this was a fortunate occurrence. We think this is unfortunate, right? How could this happen? This shouldn't be. But Ambrose called it a fortunate fall. John Owen picked up this same thing in his book on communion with God and says the same thing in so many words. I believe that John Milton, in his great epic poem, Paradise Lost, picks up the same theme. I opened one of the chapters of my book talking about that. Now, this has been well developed. There was an important Christian philosopher named Alvin Plantinga that took the approach from a very philosophical perspective, but not a theological one. And I've drawn a lot from his work on this and others who have written about it as well. But none of these scholars approached it from a explicitly theological perspective, and most certainly not from the perspective of the storyline of the Bible. But it's what is implied in this, and it's nothing new, but I've just tried to give a new face to it and explain it with some details. So there's a shape to what I call the greater glory theodicy, and you'll notice the reason why I call it greater glory is because it is really a subspecies of the greater good defense, or what we would call even the greater good theodicy. But the greater good defense, as I said before, has very kind of modest means. It just simply wants to say that, you know, we can exonerate God from moral culpability for the evil because he always has some good intention for the evil that he decrees in the world. And that's true and important as far as it goes. But it doesn't really get us very far in terms of asking the question, well, how did God actually work that out? And I believe that the greater glory theodicy, all it is really doing is just recasting the story of redemption vis-a-vis the problem of evil and helping us put all the parts and pieces of the story together that hopefully makes sense to what God is actually doing in history and in the whole story of the Bible. And so the argument goes something like this. There is an argument here that I make The first part of the argument, the first premise of the argument is this, that God's ultimate purpose in freely creating the world is to supremely magnify his glory to his image-bearing creatures, human beings. Premise A. Premise B, God's glory is supremely magnified in the atoning work of Christ, which is the sole means of accomplishing redemption for human beings. Premise C, redemption is unnecessary unless human beings have fallen into sin. Conclusion, therefore, the fall of humanity is necessary to God's ultimate purpose in creating the world. All right, let's break that down now. First part of the argument says that God's ultimate purpose in creating the world is to supremely magnify his glory. Now, I purposely put the word supremely magnify his glory because I don't want you to get the idea that God would not be glorified in anything that he had done when he decided to create. He could have created a world in which all the conditions of Eden would be present, and it would just continue that way forever and ever. And Adam and Eve would procreate, and they would fill the earth and subdue it as they were told in Genesis 1. And everything would be hunky-dory, and there would never be any crisis. There would never be any problem, and the world would just be this unending paradise forever. God could have done that. He did not. Why? Because even though I believe that God's glory would be certainly manifest in that kind of a storyline, I don't believe that it would be supremely magnified. His glory would not be supremely magnified. Now, let me stop for a moment here. And I want you to be very clear about something. When I am talking about the fact that God created the world to display his glory and to supremely magnify his glory, it's not as if somehow God needed to create the world to display his glory or to magnify his glory in any way. In other words, what we need to do is we need to distinguish between God's intrinsic glory and God's extrinsic glory, or his external, the external manifestation of his glory. God's intrinsic glory is the glory that is his by virtue of the fact that he is God. And again, he can't be any more glorious or less glorious than he is in his own being. And God had no need to create the world. It's not as if God had any needs. So the whole creation is purely a result of God's freedom because he's God. And he freely created the world, and he had a purpose in freely creating the world. And his purpose was to magnify his glory to his creatures. So that this magnification of glory is not somehow an increase in his intrinsic glory that can't be increased, but rather it is a external manifestation of glory to his creatures. That's what we're talking about when God glorifies himself in creation. He's not adding to his intrinsic glory. He's simply mirroring that glory in the creation and specifically to his creatures and very specifically to his image-bearing creatures. Us, human beings. Okay? So God could have been gloried in a perpetually unfallen world. But I don't believe God would be supremely glorified in such a world. And you might ask, well, why is that? And it's a simple question that I pose. Just think about it. And I mean, we've already said it, but think about it yourself. Where has God most supremely magnified his glory in the world. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son of God. I don't believe that there is any world, any possible world that we could imagine whereby God could magnify his glory more than a world that involved the incarnation of the second person of the Trinity, living a life of perfect obedience to the Father, submitting his life to the Father in obedience, and humbling himself to the point of death, even death on a cross, whereby he achieved atonement for the sins of fallen creatures like you and I, and rose again from the dead to demonstrate his defeat of sin and death and evil and all evil forces, and then to establish his kingdom in the world, whereby his work of redemption is magnified forever and ever and ever. There is no better story. I don't think there's a greater way that God could have magnified his glory more supremely than in that story. But if that was his goal, and I think it was, to supremely magnify his glory, and the only way to supremely magnify his glory was through this work of redemption that had to center, once he decided that was his purpose, then it committed him to sending his son as the great hero of the story in order to resolve the conflict of the cursed world that we live in. And that story would make no sense unless God had also purposed the fall. The whole conditions of Eden point to God orchestrating this plan of redemption. I mean, why did he put forbidden fruit in the garden? Why did he do that? He didn't have to do that. Why did he test Adam and Eve? Do you think God will ever test the redeemed in the eternal state? No. We will live in complete, confirmed perfection forever and ever and ever, and there will be no possibility of temptation ever again. There will be no possibility of sin ever again. There will be no need to test the redeemed in the eternal state. Why didn't he just make Adam and Eve, create them in that confirmed state of perfection forever and ever and ever, and all their progeny? He didn't. He tested them, and they failed the test. He allowed the serpent to enter into the garden to tempt Eve. Of course, this takes the story back even a little further with the fall of Satan from heaven. We won't get into all that, but it's part of the story. But why do that? Remember at the end of the fall when he cast them out of the garden? And then he put the two flaming angels at the entrance to the garden so they wouldn't enter in again and eat the forbidden fruit? Well, why didn't he just put the flaming angels at the beginning of the story to prevent the serpent from entering into the garden in the first place? Why did he create Adam and Eve with wills that were capable of succumbing to temptation when we know that we won't ever succumb to that temptation in the eternal state? The Bible doesn't have to explicitly explain all these answers to these questions. It just tells the story, and it becomes obvious that this is the way God designed it. Why? So that he could put the hero of the story on full display in the fullness of his person and work, whereby he would supremely magnify himself in a way that he could not do. He would have no occasion to do that apart from the fall. God would have no occasion to pour out his grace on wretched sinners, unless, of course, they were wretched sinners. When we extol the magnificence of his grace, and we sing about it in all of our great hymns and songs of worship, what we're doing is we are zeroing in and focusing upon the greatness of God's magnification of his glory through the grace of redemption that of necessity must be centered on his Son and his death and his resurrection, because there's no other way. There's only one name under heaven given among men by which men can be saved, the name Christ Jesus. Now, I also want to suggest that in this storyline that the restoration of paradise far outshines the pre-fall paradise. Right? This is part of the greater good, the greater glory part of the argument. Because I think the real storyline of the Bible is not just simply U-shaped. It's not creation, fall, redemption. Yes, the basics of that is true. But if we really understand what is going on, it's a J-shape. It is creation, fall, paradise restored is far greater than unfallen Eden. Why? Because of the conflict. The conflict and the severity of the conflict, the Holocaust and child trafficking and rape and murder and all of that contributes to the horrendousness of the conflict, and Jesus Christ came to defeat it all, either through redemption or judgment, right? That's another part of the storyline. God's justice will rectify every wrong, every evil that is ever done, either through the judgment of the reprobate forever, or the transfer of judgment for the redeemed upon the Redeemer in his death and resurrection, so that the demands of God's justice are satisfied one way or the other, and thereby he is glorified. And though he be glorified in judgment, I believe the greater display of his glory is in the work of redemption. You know, because he could have, you know, killed Noah and his family, said, that's it. I'm not going to start again. This is bad. This is a bad mistake. We're going to shut the whole thing down. Everyone's judged at that point. It's not what God did. He preserved Noah. He preserved the seed of the woman because he had a greater plan. And he's unfolding that plan through the death, resurrection of Christ. And the conditions of the restored paradise will be far more glorious because of the conflict. Because the conflict points to the Redeemer. I want to close before our lunch break in Revelation 5. Turn to Revelation 5. I want to draw your attention to the greatest worship scene that we see in the Bible, bar none. Revelation 5. You've got him who sits upon the throne, the Father, and the introduction of the Lamb, who is really the lion, right? Verse 5, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, right? The Jewish Messiah, the Son of God, the Son of David. He is called a lion in verse 5, but in verse 6, he says, I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing as if slain. We have the lion and the lamb in one person. In order to fulfill his status as lion, he had to become a lamb. And he had to become a lamb that would be slain. Verse 7, he came and he took out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne, this great book, which I believe is kind of a title deed to the earth. This is to demonstrate that he has authority to be the king of the earth, the king of the grand kingdom of God on earth, fulfilling all the promises that God made to the patriarchs, to Israel and to David. When the book, he'd taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each one holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, worthy are you to take the book and to break its seals, for you were slain. And you purchased for God with your blood men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Look at the focus of their worship. Look at the focus of their son. They are exalting Christ and they are saying, you are worthy. Why are you worthy of such worship, of such praise? Because you were slain and by your blood. You purchased a people from every tribe, every tongue, every people and every nation. He did not just purchase for himself Israel, but God made a promise that through Israel, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. God would not just bring redemption to Israel. He would bring redemption to the whole world, to people from every part of the world throughout all the ages. Verse 10, you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to our God, and they will reign upon the earth, beginning in the millennial kingdom. Verse 11, then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands. They're uncountable. Massive. All together saying with a loud voice. You know, if you've ever been to the Shepherd's Conference and you heard those men sing, it's incredible to hear 5,000 voices all singing together loudly, gloriously. That's nothing compared to this scene. Myriads upon myriads saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. Why does he receive this magnificent praise? Because he was slain. Because he did the greatest thing that the greatest hero could ever do. He gave his own life, his own death, And by death, he defeated death. And by death, he conquered evil. He conquered Satan. He conquered evil. And every created thing which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and on the sea and all things in them, every part of creation joins the chorus to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and dominion forever and ever. And the four living creatures kept saying, Amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped. That's why God ordained the fall, that he might supremely magnify himself through the incarnation, the life, the perfect life, death, resurrection, ascension, second coming, and eternal reign of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the one true great hero of the story. I hope that puts everything into context, because I believe that is why there is evil in the world, for Jesus to come and conquer it and to redeem a people for himself. All right, I did well and I got us done at noon. So let's take a break, go eat lunch.